like to read and comment on koan number 94 of the Hekigan Roku, the not seeing of the Sarangaba Sutra. Engo's introduction. As to what stands prior to the word, not one phrase has been handed down, even by the thousand holy ones. One thread maintains its continuity before your very eyes through countless eons. Entirely pure, entirely naked is the white ox under the blue sky. The golden-haired lion stands with eyes upturned, ears erect. Put the lion aside for the moment and tell me, what is the white ox under the blue sky? And then the case. In the Sarangama Sutra, the Buddha says, when I do not see, why do you not see my not seeing? If you see my not seeing, naturally this is no longer not seeing. If you do not see my not seeing, how could it not be you? The whole elephant or the whole ox, both blinding cataracts, the wisest have groped in the dark. Do you want to see the golden-haired Buddha? Through countless eons, none is more than halfway there. Let's start with the introduction, and then we'll see whether we can penetrate this koan. As to what stands prior to the word, not one phrase has been handed down, even by the thousand holy ones. Before the thought I am arises, what is there? One could say that one of the great difficulties on the way is that we just don't realize how radical the practice is. We're a bit like, as Gurdjieff says, trying to get into heaven with our boots on. We always come to the practice after the word, after the thought I am arises. What this means is once we come to I am or mu, after the thought has arisen. We bring with us all of our expectations, all of our prejudices, opinions, and so on. And by expectations, we don't simply mean the expectations about Kensho and so on. These are comparatively mild, and most people wear them out more or less after the first two or three sessions. But it's rather the expectations about how the mind should operate. It's the prejudices about how we should go about resolving a problem. And it's the sort of hidden opinions that we have about ourselves with the feeling that we really know already as a consequence of these opinions, and that one way or another, what we're going to do is to confirm those opinions. One of the things that is interesting is with beginners. One doesn't get it with people that have been to a few sesshins. But people that come to the sesshin for the first time, or sometimes to Doksan for the first time, come in order that one would be able to say to them, you are fully awakened. How amazing you are. We've had several people that would come, and each Doksan would be an arm wrestling. They would nitpick with me and say, but you said, I said, we said, all in the endeavor to turn, so that I would eventually turn around and say, yes, you're right. We were just talking to somebody the other day who used to come to the sender. He'd come to several workshops, have several sesshins and so on. And on one occasion, he told me about an experience that he had. It was an interesting experience. It was a kind of samadhi. But the way he told it, it was quite evident that this had really become something that gave him the biggest boost that he could have, in a way. And what he was, again, as we were saying, wanting me to confirm, was that this was it. Let me say that when it is it, you won't need confirmation, I promise you. What you do need is somebody to say, no, that is not it. Go deeper. That's all that you need. If you need somebody to tell you that it is it, you know, you really do know that it is not it. There's no question about it. Please don't feel that it's something that is still under a bushel. It isn't. That's the whole point. But anyway, this fellow presented this thing to me with quite a bit of bombast and so on. And so we just brushed it aside. And I said, well, that's not too much. Have you got anything else? Can you tell me something more about yourself, more immediately, about your practice right now? And apparently it did work all right. It cut this man right down, and he refused ever to come back, and he's been nursing this sort of resentment, from the sounds of it, ever since. These prejudices, these assumptions, particularly this assumption that I do know. Because the funny part about it is that we do know. This is the twist. One of the things that's going to come out, as far as this koan is concerned, is that Buddha does not know he is Buddha. God does not know he is God, or she is God. The awakened person does not know they're awakened. This is one of the things that Dogen said. And this is true. You don't know. But you are awakened. And by awakened, we mean that you know fully. You are knowing itself. When we come to look at our koan, if you're working on who am I, when you're looking into this question, I am, or when you're looking into mu, The problem is our mind plays a trick on us. It is an artificial way that you look at this question. One is already trapped. This is something that it seems to me almost all philosophers never realized. The very coming to the question with an armful of weapons, of tricks, of methods, of logics, has already set the problem up in terms of what the problem is not. That is no longer the problem. That is a problem, but it is not the problem. Scientists are certain that what they're doing is studying the universe, studying the world. What they don't seem to realize is that they are studying the world. In other words, what is coming out is not only about the world, but the way they are studying it. It's true that modern physicists are beginning to say this, of course. You can't separate the observer from the experiment that he's observing, and so on. But this is true, again, of this question, what is mu, or who am I? This is why, before the word is spoken, what is it? Is the question. Before the thought, I am, arises, what are you? Now, if you're going to look at this before simply in terms of a time before and after, and of course, if you're going to be logical, you're going to point out to me that this is impossible. And you're right. But we're not talking in terms of time, but in terms of order. Where does the thought, I am, come from, if you like? It's another way of asking that same question. And this is really what this koan is about. And as the Engo says here, you just cannot say anything about it. And when you demonstrate, you're not demonstrating it. You are it. If you're demonstrating the answer to the question that I asked, who comes in to the door, it's no good. No matter how good the demonstration is, it isn't it. You must be it. This is the whole point. And as we say, you are it. This is the... Once we bring the mind to bear, the mind brings with it all of its trappings. And this is not only true, of course, when you're working on a koan, but any time that you reflect upon yourself, upon others, upon the situation in which you're living, upon the future, upon the past, you are always bringing this set of trappings with you. You're always looking at it through this film, through this structure. And the question that we must ask ourselves is, before that structure arises, what is there? There was a very interesting example of this business of people seeing it according to their structure, according to their expectations, prejudices, and opinions. There was the World Health Organization group in Africa, decided that what they had to do was to educate the Africans in making sure that there were no puddles of water around in tins or boxes or whatever or in the ground, in which mosquitoes could breed, and if they could do that, then it would mean that they would be able to stamp out malaria. And the question was, how could you educate the Africans into appreciating the importance of this activity? And so some bright spark decided that the best thing to do would be to make a film. So sure enough, they made a film of people carefully picking up a tin, pouring out the empty pouring out the water, picking up a box, pouring out the water, filling in the puddles so that there was no water left, and this went on and so on. And so they made this film, and they started taking it round, showing the African people in little groups this film. And then after a while, somebody said, look, I wonder if the message is getting across. Perhaps we ought to just check back, get some feedback. So sure enough, they went off and they sat down with this person and said, now tell me, what did you see in the film? Just describe what the film showed you. And the person said, I saw a chicken. He said, you saw what? I said, well, I saw a chicken. Well, anyway, they were completely bewildered by this, and they said, now, what does he mean, saw a chicken? So anyway, they decided to run the film through slowly, and sure enough, about a third of the way through the film, a chicken sort of rushes across the corner of the film. Now, this is the problem. When people are sitting down doing their practice, what they're seeing is the chicken. Now, this is what we say, that we don't realize how radical the practice is. It's a bit like you're going to turn a glove inside out. The glove is still exactly the same. It's still a glove. It's got four fingers and a thumb. It's got a palm, and so on. But now it is completely different. This is why we keep saying to people, it's nothing to do with the personality. The personality is the sort of the ups and downs, the fingers and the thumb, if you like, of the glove. But the whole thing is radically changed. And this is one of the things that we keep trying to get across, is that you are not what you think you are. You are just not what you think you are. And the tremendous release that comes when one appreciates this. It's almost as though you are outside your home and you're running around trying to get inside your home. And then there's something sort of happens, and all of a sudden you find that all the time you've been inside your home. Is this change from outside to inside, which is really what is at issue? But you can't do it with the mechanisms that you bring to it. Someone said it's a bit like trying to climb a mountain made of glass that has no foot handholds or handholds. Another person said it's a bit like a mosquito trying to bore through an iron plate with a proboscis. Now, the introduction goes on and says, as to what stands prior to the word, not one phrase has been handed down. One thread maintains its continuity before your very eyes through countless eons. What is this one thread? This is what the koan is about. So let's leave that for a moment. Entirely pure, entirely naked, is the white ox under the blue sky. Now, as you know, the ox, in the ox herding pictures, is one of the symbols, one of the few symbols in Zen, and that is the Buddha nature. And what it says is entirely pure, entirely naked is the white ox under the blue sky. It is this purity, this nakedness, this unobstructedness that is the problem. Under the blue sky, in other words, what it keeps emphasizing is the openness. It is not the nothingness, it is the openness. It's the purity. Sometimes we say to people, you're looking through it. The golden-haired lion stands with eyes upturned, ears erect. The golden-haired lion, actually this, of course, is Manjushri. Manjushri is very often depicted on a lion, and very often it's a lion that is sort of very much alert, very much about to pounce kind of thing. And this image of Manjushri and the lion gives the kind of tensile quality that this mind has when it is truly investigating one's true nature, this kind of vitality that is necessary. If you want to get a sort of a, it's not a very good idea, but it does give you an idea, you must see pause. When pause moves fast, she doesn't do it very much any longer, but when she does, there's a kind of streaking quality to her. When she leaps, there's a kind of total control, total there-ness. And it's this kind of presence that one must cultivate in one's practice. And then he says, put the lion aside for the moment and tell me, what is the white ox under the blue sky? Or what stands prior to the word? And then we come to the case. In the Sarangama Sutra, Buddha says, when I do not see, why do you not see my not seeing? The original, of course, would not have had this I in it and this me. It would have been something like, when there is not seeing, why is there not seeing that not seeing? We've just said that Buddha does not know he is Buddha. God does not know she is God. It's as Buddha once said, throughout heaven and earth, I alone am the honored one. What we're talking about is everything. When I say that you are not what you think you are, you think you are something. But indeed, you are everything. And the problem, once one says you are everything, it gives an idea of your being a collection, a tremendous collection. And furthermore, people again bring in their thoughts about what everything means, and they start thinking about the furthest stars and galaxies and the other side of the moon and things like that. What is everything right now? Where would you find the end of everything right now? Where would you begin to see the beginning of everything right now? How do you grasp everything right now? In a way, this gives a kind of taste of what it is that we're talking about. But as we say, to say that you are everything just doesn't work, because everything, as we say, has got all kinds of connotations, all kinds of additions and expectations and so on attached to it. When you speak any word, you have to invoke, or at least infer, all other words. A word is not a word in isolation. A word is always a word in a network. And as a consequence, as we say, when you bring in a word, you bring in a world. But what is there before that word? When I do not see, why do you not see my not seeing? There is no reflection in this not seeing. One must understand that people say Buddha is blind, and there are different kinds of blindness. There is, of course, the blindness of a person who just has no eyes or whose eyes have been damaged. That's a physical blindness. But then there is the blindness that we're talking about when all that we see is the chicken. This is not complete blindness, it's partial blindness. And most of us are partially blind. But then there's the blindness of a person who first gets on the first kensho, just after the first kensho. Because all that person sees for the moment is just emptiness. It's just, wow, kind of. It's not integrated. It's not, the world has not taken its correct place again, you might say. It's a not seeing. But then there's the blindness of Buddha. It's like the not knowing of Bodhidharma. And this not knowing is your not knowing. It's really only under certain conditions that you are aware of reflection. A lot of the time, the reflection is going on, but it is in a kind of sleep, in a kind of dream state. Most people spend most of their time, most of their lives, in this dream state. There's a kind of rumbling thought, or monologue, that goes on from the time they get up in the morning till the time they go to bed, and in actual fact is probably one of the big threads that go through dreams as well. There's this inner mono-duologue, and the day revolves around that kind of activity. But there is no awareness, although that activity comes out of a reflective awareness, there is no awareness of that going on. And so when it's said that Buddha is not aware of being Buddha, you have at least got an analogy, at least you've got a metaphor for what is meant. But beyond that rambling monologue is, you know, you are already knowing. That knowing is never extinguished. Let me read something now, also from the Sarangama Sutra. It's a bit long, and it is a little bit philosophical, but please see whether you can stay with the what is being said. Buddha struck a gong and asked Ananda if he had heard the sound of it. Ananda replied that he had. After the vibration had died away, Buddha asked, "Do you still hear it?" Ananda said he no longer heard it. So there's the gong, and then he says, "No, I don't hear it anymore because the sound has gone." Buddha struck the gong again and said, "Did you hear the striking of the gong?" "Yes," said Ananda. "Why is it," Buddha asked, "that at one time you say you hear and another time that you do not?" Ananda replied at once, "Lord, when the gong was struck, I heard the sound. But when the vibration died away, the sound ceased. That is what I meant when I said that at one time I heard, and at another time, I did not hear." Now we can extend this hearing also to knowing. Again, Buddha struck the gong and inquired of Ananda if he could still hear. Ananda replied that he could. After a while, the sound ceased, and Buddha asked again, "Do you still hear?" And Ananda replied, a little impatiently this time, "No, Lord." "The sound has ceased. How can I hear?" The Buddha said, "Ananda, what is the meaning of this? At one time you say you hear, and at another time you say you do not hear." And then Ananda replied, "Lord, when the gong is struck, there is sound." "When the sound ceases, there is no sound." Buddha interrupted and said, "Ananda, why do you make such confused statements?" Ananda retorted, "Lord, why do you charge me with making confused statements? I only speak the facts." And then Buddha replied, "Why indeed? You do not seem to realize that the sound of the gong, the hearing of the sound, and the perception of the hearing are three different things. For you reply without any recognition of the difference." Let me read that again. You've got the gist now. He strikes the gong and he says, "Do you hear?" He says, "Yes, I hear." When the gong has stopped, he says, do you hear?" And Ananda says, "No, I don't hear because the sound has stopped." And Buddha says, "You do not realize that the sound of the gong, the hearing of the sound, and the perceptions of or hearing the hearing are three different things. For you replied without any recognition of the difference." And then he says, "There is a difference between sound and no sound on the one hand and hearing and no hearing on the other. or there is a difference between seeing and feeling and hearing on the one hand and knowing on the other. He says, sound and no sound are momentary. They come and go. The gong is struck, and then the gong is not struck. So they come and go. Sound and no sound is momentary, while hearing and no hearing are permanent. Sound and no sound are imaginary. Hearing belongs to the pure essence of the mind. By means of this illustration, you must see that in spite of the destruction of your body and the gradual exhaustion of the vitality of your life, that the essential nature of the hearing conception is not destroyed, nor cease to exist. Ananda, if you could only learn to get free from this bondage to deaths and rebirths. The deaths and rebirths are the deaths and rebirths of the sound, of the perceptions. From this fear of impermanency, what is impermanent are the sounds, are the sights, are the feelings. And learn to concentrate your mind on its true and permanent nature of permanency, then the eternal brightness would illumine you, and then all the individualized and discriminated perceptions of objective phenomena, sense organs, false imaginings, self and not self would vanish, because the phenomena of the thinking mind are only empty and transitory things, and the differentiated emotions of your mortal consciousness are only passing phenomena. Now, when you're working on who am I, the thought, who am I, is the gong. It is not the knowing the gong. The thought, who am I, comes and goes. The knowing the thought, who am I, doesn't come and go. Now, he says, in the Sarangama Sutra, it says that it is permanent, but this is only really permanent against the impermanence of sound. One must be careful that one doesn't think there is some substratum of knowing, there is some substance called knowing, which underlies everything, because if you do that, you are simply carrying forward the prejudice that you have that the mind must be something. There is no substratum, but that does not mean to say the mind is impermanent. But the whole thing is that you know sounds, you know sights. But when the sight ceases, you say, I don't see. Or when the sound stops, you say, I don't hear. Or when the thinking stops, you say, I don't know. And this is because all that you know are what you hear, what you see, what you feel. This to you is the world. But when we say there has to be a radical shift, there has to be a radical shift away from the world to the knowing. Now, when we say that, the problem with people is that they then try to know the knowing from outside in a gesture of self-reflection. And a lot of meditation that goes on is of this kind. And it is this kind of meditation that the masters warn us against as being the dead void sitting. Actually, this kind of sitting can lead into a kind of samadhi. There is a marriage of these two awarenesses, and it can lead to a kind of sublime state and so on. But it is all dead end. And in actual fact, this kind of practice can lead people to be very aloof, very cold, very superior towards others and so on. But the question is, how can you know knowing not from the outside? And the answer is, it is in the nature of knowing only to know from within. In other words, the secret is to get to the I am before the thought I am arises. As soon as the thought I am arises, one is already outside. What this requires, it sounds, people say, well, I don't know what you're talking about, but the thing is that one has to come to it, as it says, in a state of purity and nakedness. This is why we keep on asking people, don't come and practice Zen. Unfortunately, we have to give you something like a question, who am I or what is Mu? I say this is very, very unfortunate. But if we didn't, if we just sat and looked at you, you would wonder what the devil was going on. There is one teacher who, any student that comes, he doesn't say anything, he just holds out his hand to shake the person's hand. And then when the person sits and looks rather bewildered, the master says, that is your koan. Well, that might work for some people, but for most of us, we wouldn't know which way to turn with it. But it is a very good koan, and it is a very good way of working. In other words, one doesn't bring any... He tries to encourage people to bring nothing to bear on the koan. We've said it, any movement of the mind is already too much. We've said you are already whole and complete. You know. We say have faith in yourself. You can have lived a life of total failure. You could be a total failure in everything you've ever done in your life. And this doesn't matter one iota. On the other hand, you could be the most brilliant scientist or philosopher or theologian or whatever, and this wouldn't help you one tiny, tiny little bit. Because we all start from the beginning. We all start from the origin. And all that is necessary is for us to let go of our cleverness. This is why we were saying the other day that the intellectual has such a hard time. This koan is an invitation to utter simplicity. Although when one reads it, it reads like a twisted up conundrum. It is calling on the uttermost simplicity. When I do not see, why do you not see my not seeing? In other words, one enters in simply into this condition of not seeing or not knowing. But you see, really the not knowing with which you are familiar is the not knowing of a fact. You are familiar with people saying, no, you don't know. You've had exam after exam in your lives, quite likely, and all that people are looking for is what you don't know. And you're trembling when you hand in your paper in case it's found out that you don't know. And this whole sort of notion of not knowing is an absence of fact, or an absence of the ability to twist the mind in the way that the particular professor wants you to twist your mind in order to produce the fact he's looking for. In other words, it is an artificial problem that you've got here. I'm not saying it's not an important problem in terms of the world, and all of my attacks on science have got nothing whatsoever to do with the value of science as an institution in our society. All I'm saying is once it steps into the realm of truth, of what we're talking about here, then it's out of its league. And this not knowing, there is another not knowing, which is as the alchemists say, our sun is a black sun. The light of Buddha is a black light. It is a black light because it is so brilliant. If you know from outside the knowing, it is not the knowing. This is what it says. If you see my not seeing, naturally that is no longer not seeing. Once you get outside it, once you see it, once you grasp this mind, if you can't grasp it, but you keep on trying to grasp it, this is trying to see my not seeing or know my not knowing. It is a self-luminous gem. It does not need any help from anywhere to shine. And then it says, if you do not see my not seeing, how could it not be you? This very not knowing is what you are. But then if you come to that not knowing with your bag full of paper and old rags like a bag lady, then you will not follow what is being said. You are already Buddha. You are already awakened. This is what this koan is saying. Before the thought, I am, arises, you are brilliant. And then you darken it. You go into obscurity by saying, I don't know what you're talking about. What is it all about? This is too difficult for me. I've had to find another practice. This won't work. I can't do this. In the Soto Zen, they talk of Shikantaza. And ultimately, this is what we are talking about. But the problem is that in this, many of the Soto Zen, I'm not attacking Soto Zen in general, but many of the Soto Zen think it's a thing that anybody can do, a beginner can do. But as Yasutani said, if you're going to sit in Shikantaza for half an hour, then you better be sweating at the end of it. Again, we don't mean that literally, of course. And he didn't mean it literally. How do you not do? There's the koan of all koans. Think the unthinkable. The koan of all koans. And it's because you are trying to think the unthinkable with your bag full of tricks that you suffer. Every incident in life is seen through this structure of what you think you are. In the verse it says, the whole elephant or the whole ox, blinding cataract. You know the story very well of the men that investigated, the blind men that investigated the elephant. And one grabbed hold of its trunk and said, an elephant is like a big tube, big fat tube. Another one grabbed hold of its tusk and said, no, it's a smooth thing that goes to a point. Another one grabs hold of his ear and says, no, it's a big flat thing, like a big leaf. And another one grabs hold of its tail and says, oh, no, it's like a big piece of rope. And then a man who could see came along and laughed, because he could see the whole elephant. But of course, he was as blind as the rest of them. This is what this says. There is no whole elephant. If there's no whole elephant, if there's no not everything, and I say that you are everything, if there is no whole elephant, what is there? And he says, the wisest have groped in the dark. You see, when one tries to talk about it, one's groping in the dark. I say that you are everything, and that's the tail. I say you are already awakened, and that's the leg. I say that you must arouse the mind without resting on anything, and that's the ear. What is the whole? Do you want to see the golden-haired Buddha? Through countless eons, none is more than halfway there. Someone said, if you are anywhere, you are only halfway. If you are nowhere, then you are there.
All beings without number,
I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dharma gaze beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain